Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. All over the world and throughout history, music has been a vital part of affecting social and political change. At times, the powers that be resist that change by oppressing music and the arts. How has music shaped politics historically, and how is it changing politics today? We're joined by three experts. Josh Kuhn is professor of communication and journalism and also the director of the Popular Music Project at USC Annenberg's Norman Lear Center. He's also author of Audiotopia, Music, Race, and America, and co-editor of the book series Refiguring American Music. Mark Levine is with us. He is professor of Middle Eastern History at University of California, Irvine. His books include Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil, and Heavy Metal Islam, Rock, Resistance, and the Story of Islam's Generation X. Richard Flax is Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is the author of Making History, The American Left and the American Mind, and Playing for Change, Music and Musicians in the Service of Social Movements. Dick Flax, I'm going to start with you to put this into a historic and political context with Woody Guthrie and also his fellow cohort of artists and how they have helped to shape American politics as we have it today.
Well, I would say more specifically, helped to shape American dissent or protest politics, social movements. That was the goal that Woody Guthrie and his colleagues, if you want to call them that, in the early years of the 1940s, late 1930s, set out to do. They had a project, which I think Woody, among others, described as taking traditional music rather than the popular mainstream music of the day and putting lyrics to that music that would deal with contemporary issues, and particularly in their day, the labor movement. And I think when you learn about them, then you can possibly think back for decades, back to the 19th century. The labor movement in this country, as well as other places, always had a strong musical dimension to it. And Woody and his people like Pete Seeger and others picked up that thread and tried to revitalize that at the time that I'm referring to. I think, though, that the main impact of that project politically really was in the 60s by what's been called the children and grandchildren of Woody Guthrie, Dylan most famously, who introduced this form of musical expression just when the mass movements of the 60s were emerging and helped to shape particularly the student movement, the youth revolt, the anti-war movement of the 60s through the songs that provide a shared identity, I think, for what ended up being millions of people, really.
So we have a shared identity. And then, Josh Kuhn, maybe this is the perfect place to bring you in, because you've looked at U.S. musical history as being intertwined with the history of race and ethnicity and identity. How do you see this interacting?
Well, I think that if you go back and you even just start with the very kind of foundations of the notion of America itself, the very kind of mythical promise of a democratic America, we see that song and music have long been central to debates around that. And the most obvious place to look there, of course, is in the music of slaves and in the sorrow songs of newly arrived Africans and African Americans in the United States, where music might not have sounded political, might not have announced itself as a protest song in the way that as we just heard in the 1960s, it really took shape in that way. But in the early days, of course, when we're talking about sorrow songs and slave songs, you're talking about music that had codes, music that didn't announce itself as overtly protest or oppositional, but served a political function. And I think throughout the history of the very notion of America, the history of the United States itself, music has always been a site for struggle around the meanings of freedom and liberty. And that's still the case to this very day.
Mark Levine, you've argued in your work that music is a better way of understanding culture and societies, particularly in the Middle East, than are many other means. Why do you say that?
Well, there's several reasons. First of all, music is one of the oldest and most profound cultural expressions, and so many other aspects of culture come through it. So, for example, prayer and religious performance is very often traditionally expressed musically. Certainly, in the Middle East, there's a very old tradition of protest poetry and then music, you know, going back at least into the 30s, 40s, 50s. You see this naturally in the protests, whether in Tahrir Square in Cairo, and I was there, and so much music just naturally exploding from there, or in Tunisia, or in Syria, where at least one of the major poet singers there was brutally murdered. And in Morocco, another one is in jail, you know, on potentially trumped up politicized charges, a rapper. It's also a way of seeing commonalities. I think so much of the problem when Americans look at other cultures, especially the Middle East, where we have so many conflicts and so many misunderstandings, music is a way of seeing the commonalities between the struggles everyone shares. And I think when you see the, you know, really strong influence, let's say, the early 2010-11 revolts had on the Occupy movement in Europe and the U.S., you can see how, especially through music and through poetry and through this artistic expression, they were able to create solidarities between movements in different countries that otherwise would have been much harder to have.
You bring up another important point, which is the oppression of the arts as a means of maybe oppressing a certain kind of communication or a solidarity. Tell us a little bit about this oppression that you've seen.
I don't want to overemphasize, as some people have done, but one of the causal factors in the explosion of protests in Tunisia was the jailing of this one rapper, El General, who wrote a song called Rais Le Bled, President of the Country, where he was, you know, really just begging the president at that point, Ben Ali, to just understand the cost of his policies and his avarice and greed and violence on a generation. And when he was arrested, young people came out in even bigger numbers to protest his jailing. And that was the first symbol that you can use a music that is specifically related to the generation that's revolting as a means of communicating. You know, Chuck D, Public Enemy, famously said that hip-hop was the CNN of the street of Black America, essentially. And this is exactly what this music became in the Middle East, whether it was hip-hop or for 2 decades before that, music like heavy metal and other so-called Western genres, hardcore punk, were used by young people to express their anger and frustration at a system from which they were severely marginalized. And this has continued. If you look at Egypt, the quote-unquote singer of the revolution, Rami Hassan, was grabbed off the street and severely tortured by the Egyptian authorities in the wake of the Egyptian revolution when they next had protests, I think, March of 2011. And just all across the board, wherever there's been these revolts in the Arab world of the last 2 years, musicians and also other types of artists have been at the forefront, and governments have gone after them because of that, because they understand that they're able to communicate in a means that the governments can't compete with. And they can reach people, especially with the internet, but also through live performances and bringing people together in a way that governments can't do. And I'll just give you one example from the last time I was in Egypt with Rami Hassan. He was performing at a major protest, tens of thousands of people in Tahrir Square, and there was all this conflict between the Salafis, or the ultra-religious, and the secular forces. And when he came on the stage, he brought with him a huge number of these ultra-soccer fans who had been so crucial to the revolution, at least on the streets and the fighting. And they barreled through all the Salafis to establish a presence there. But once he started playing, you can see Salafis coming and sort of drifting over and listening to the music and nodding their head to his songs, because his songs ultimately were about freedom and against the government and reflected exactly what they were feeling. So even though from an orthodox religious perspective they maybe should not have been listening to it, they couldn't help but listen to it. And for that moment at least, the Salafis and the ultras suddenly understood, and they were in the same space and seeing they had a common enemy, which was the government and the military. And that's precisely the kind of thing that music can do that almost no other art form can do.
Josh Kuhn, talk about what you've seen in Mexico.
In Mexico, in some ways similar to the things that Mark was describing in the Middle East, during the election year, the growing student movement, Yo Soy 132, the Yo Soy 132 student movement, was a movement that actually, when it started, didn't have much music at its core, but gradually music became a central part of how students were organizing themselves and not only expressing their political views in opposition to the right-wing political parties in Mexico, but how they were actually using music as a way to figure out community, as a way to figure out what their ideas were. So I guess what I find really interesting is both how music can be a direct form of expression, as Mark was talking about it, but also can be the very kind of ground for the building of a community that allows that expression to happen. In Mexico, we've been seeing that all over the place, where music has been in marches, but also been a way for students to just have an excuse to get together, to write songs together, to formulate and rehearse ideas that then enter into a larger kind of public debate.
I can recall a time in Chile post-coup that the particular kind of music was banned, and yet people would sneak it on the air on the sly. But soft oppression that we've had here in the U.S. during the McCarthy era and even post-9/11, Dick Flax, could you speak to that?
Well, we do have some great stories of the martyrdom of troubadours in this country. One example before the time you're mentioning was Joe Hill, who was the sort of supreme songwriter of the industrial workers of the world, the wobbly revolutionary labor movement in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. He was tried and executed for murder in Salt Lake City, Utah in 1915, a funeral with 100,000 people in Chicago after his execution. The big McCarthy moment people remember in terms of music was Pete Seeger. He was called before the Un-American Activities Committee. He was one of many entertainers, of course, who experienced that, but Pete took the stance that he would not respond to their questions because the government had no right to ask the questions. And that led to a contempt citation by Congress. He faced a year in jail, but he ultimately won his court case. But that certainly added to the definition of him as a figure of protest and a symbol of strong dissent during that particular period. I'm not sure that repression is the main story in the United States about the uses of music, but I think what we've heard already is that any time you have this kind of musical development, and particularly the emergence of sort of troubadours with a kind of heroic quality to them, they often become targets for the regime, and that move on the part of the regime that's feeling itself threatened can backfire badly. The big moment of supreme repression of music was the torture and execution of Victor Jara, the great troubadour of the Chilean protest in the early 70s. His death really has stayed as a kind of symbol for decades after that, globally, of the power of song, I guess, and of almost Christ-like figure that emerges from music in many, many parts of the world. It's quite amazing how troubadours can take on that symbolic value for large numbers of people. And the effort to suppress them, as has been said, is very dangerous because it's in the mass popular consciousness and a shared feeling that this music has reached. So when you start to repress it, people who might otherwise not be sure of their politics begin to see this as the true nature of the regime, the repression.
Josh Kuhn, you have looked at Gil Scott-Heron saying music being a melodic form of guerrilla warfare.
This is in the context of a kind of larger examination of the role of music in the Black Power movement. And what's interesting about that quote from Scott-Heron is he both was talking about songs that lyrically were staging a protest, but also just the way that, let's say, in an instrumental piece, I believe the original context for that was that when he was a young boy in music school, the idea that he would play classical music on a piano when his teacher wasn't in the room and make changes to the pieces that he was playing, that was his own form of protest. And so I think it's equally important, as Mark was signaling a bit earlier, that, you know, lyrics clearly are what we so often focus on, with good reason, but also in instrumental songs, just the choice of style, Western pieces versus Eastern pieces, songs that sound, quote-unquote, too Black, too Mexican, too Jewish, songs that disrupt the kind of dominant sonic racial order. Throughout time, just the sound of something can be disruptive enough to cause protest, to cause debate, to cause change. And so I think part of what he was getting at there is that the choices that we make as listeners, the choices that we make as musicians, the music we choose to play and how we choose to play it are aesthetic choices that have social impact.
Mark Levine, let's bring you in on that. Is that what you're seeing also in these changing areas in the Middle East?
I think certainly music is helping to break down boundaries, absolutely. I guess we could also think of Fela Kuti, who said music is the weapon of the future. I think his last album was named that, and he was someone who knew a lot about regime oppression. They literally threw his mother out the window of his house and killed her because of his political activities. if people look at this organization, FreeMuse, a Danish organization that is basically the Amnesty International for musicians, it's amazing how many musicians around the world right now are suffering severely, whether censored, repression, torture, jail, or murdered, or assassinated for their activities and their music. What I think is clear is that music on its own can't do it, but it's very hard to spread revolution without a cultural marker that can grab people together. You know, music is not a sufficient condition. You know, you can have revolutionary music and not have the revolution. But it's hard to think of revolutions that didn't have some kind of musical component that wasn't just expressing what was already there, but expressing it in a way that amplified it. And I think great music does two things. It amplifies, so it takes what everyone is saying and it boils it down to the most powerful elements and then sends it out even louder. But it also is a kind of prism. It also refracts and breaks apart dominant ideologies and makes it easier to critique or to take what you already, you know, to use, let's say, the idea of Gramsci about common sense versus good sense. Great revolutionary music would take everyone's common sense and turn it into good sense, and that what everyone sort of knows will become something that they can trust their ears. Now, they can trust that what they're suspecting is true, but they can also act on it, and it gives you, you know, both hope and possibility. At least in the music I've been following in the Arab world the last 2 years, that's really what makes it so special. And I think when you look at Woody Guthrie, of course, or any of the great protest movement, Pete Seeger, or for that matter, Public Enemy, or even after 9/11, I think at one point there were over 100 hip-hop songs that have been written in protest against the post-9/11 militarization of American politics that, unless you were listening to KPFK or something, you probably didn't hear, but the artists were out there, and there were these sub-communities, and they were being heard. In all these places, there's still pockets where music is at the forefront and is carrying the torch, so to speak, to keep things lit. And again, I don't want to say that music is more powerful than, let's say, a play or a poem or a piece of graffiti, but out of all those, it's the only one that you can join in on, right? You can read a poem, but you're not going to join, but that's not a communal experience. You can go see a piece of graffiti. You can go see a play. You can watch a movie. You can read a book. But music's the only one where you can gather around with everyone and all do the art together. And that's what I think makes it a uniquely powerful medium for protesting and then transcending.
Dick Flax, let me add to that, because I think that's a very important point. There is something unique about singing as an art form, and I think you put your finger on a good part of it, the idea of gathering around. And as Seeger has tried to show, singing together is a very empowering experience. All religions know that, of course. National anthems sung together, but social movements. What I wanted to add was that it's a unique art form because you don't need an artist in a specialized sense to create or reproduce the song. The song becomes everybody's property. You can sing the song yourself without any talent or trained capacity as a musician. You keep it in your consciousness. It's part of your being in a way that I don't think there's any other art form that can quite do this. Yip Harburg, who was a great political Broadway lyricist, he said a song is the unique way in which thought and feeling are fused, which I think is another part of trying to define why this is a particularly important political means of expression. So it's the bringing together of people. It's the creation of some sense of empowerment when people are singing together. It's the combination of ideas and emotion in a fused way. And there are many different functions of particular songs. Some are these collective empowerments. Some are songs that have ideas that you, the creator of the song, are trying to convey to others. And there's therefore very complicated songs as well as very chant-like songs. One of the great protest songs was Give Peace a Chance by John Lennon. Great because everyone could sing it in mass rallies at the end of the war protest movement. Millions of people were singing this together. So it was a brilliant invention by Lennon of the most simple idea of how a song can work for empowerment purposes.
This is Josh Kuhn. I think the idea of music as a mode of public gathering and of bringing people together to sing together, to join voices, to raise voices in unison is obviously a very, very important point. And I just want to add to that, though, is that there's also the other aspect, which is the non-public part of music, which is to say the power of being able to listen to a recording in private, in your bedroom, on headphones, actually outside of the public gaze, so that you can retreat to a kind of sense of private refuge, to use music as a way to imagine worlds that you didn't think were actually possible, or worlds that were actively being shut down in front of your very eyes and ears. So that, for me, part of what makes music so singularly special, I think, in many ways, as a political tool, is how it keys into a broader sense of what politics are. This idea that music can allow you to imagine worlds that you didn't think were otherwise going to be possible. And often we need to be alone and in private for that to happen.
A few other aspects of this that I think about in today's music world, particularly in the United States, and it's something that Mark Levine, you mentioned, which is oftentimes these really great music doesn't get heard, particularly in a consolidated radio world where there's not very much exploration of things that veer outside of what the establishment sees as commercial. And so I wonder if music can still play this role in the U.S. if they're A, not hearing some of this great music, but B, if they're misunderstanding some of it.
Dick Flex, I've been really preoccupied with that question for quite a while now. Radio is no longer the framework, even though I also have my own radio show, where most people, I think younger people particularly, are getting awareness of music. You just go to YouTube and look for certain musicians, you'd be quite amazed by how many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have made hits on various things that you may not have heard in any other context. So I'm not sure we know all that much about how people are getting access to cultural forms, musical forms, song and performances now, but it's the opportunity for people to hear about this far transcends what radio was ever able to bring to people or what CDs are able to bring to people. And it's hard to even know what the channels of communication are among people, young people in particular, that lead them to find out about these kinds of things online and find them. But there are hundreds and hundreds of people writing songs now coming out of the Occupy movement. There just was a 4-CD album released with 99 Occupy songs. That's a lot of songs, but there's still more of them if you go to YouTube or other, just go online and look for them. I don't know what people who are producing these songs think their fate will be. It seems like people want to get their performances out there. It's cheap and technologically very feasible now to do it, so people are doing it. And whether a particular song is shared by a lot of people and known by a lot of people is one sort of question which may be hard to answer from this great Tower of Babel of music that is now out there. But certainly the creativity is happening, and I think when people are in mass protests like the Occupy types of protests, they're bound to be coming up with songs or sharing songs. And some of the major performers, Tom Morello is one of the best examples, has been going around a lot in the old Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger way to these rallies and singing and creating these songs that can be sung by people in that context.
I think that's a really great point, Mark Levine. And I think the sad part is Morello is one of the few people who's doing this on a regular basis. What's actually shocking to me in the U.S. context is how completely all these major supposedly liberal performers who, you know, will give you a benefit for Obama, you didn't see them in Wisconsin the way you'd see Morello and one or two other people. And that's something I think in America that's really sad, that how divorced even people like Springsteen and others, who at one point were much more politically active, have become, from being out there with their music on the grassroots, they might do a big song like U2 might do a song about Iran when they had the protests after the 2009 election, but they're not doing anything that's actually putting themselves on the line.
Well, you know, I would like not to make such a sweeping generalization, because if you take Springsteen himself, not only did he put out his most political album, which is very related to the Occupy movement, but I've seen, if you go to YouTube and see some of his performances, they're very much embracing in these large mass concert venues, the movement. He hasn't necessarily gone to
I certainly agree with you there, but I guess for me, coming from the Middle Eastern context, I think there's something crucial about being at the site.
Oh, I agree with that.
Creating the community there. Yes, absolutely agree. It's last, you know, very political, but I think it's very crucial for people to be with the people protesting because it brings more people down and it helps create the numbers. And I'm not sure why, for the most part, most of the big name so-called liberal artists or progressive artists have not really made it a point of making Occupy their own, because had they done that, I think they would have helped sustain this movement after that initial burst inevitably was going to die down. And, you know, Morello can't be everywhere, right? And there needs to be other people. And just when you have musicians, for example, in Bahrain or in Morocco or others, when the musicians are willing to go out and sacrifice themselves either by being arrested or being on the front lines or being hosed down or even worse, beaten, this, in a way, really motivates so many other people to do the same thing. And somehow in America, we've been so far removed, even our musical elite, from being willing to do that, that it really makes it much harder for the music that we do have to have the kind of political impact that it might otherwise have, at least in my opinion.
I think that one other thing that's important to mention here, though, is, of course, if we look at the biggest civil rights marches in the history of the United States, which happened in 2006 and 2007, pro-immigration marches that gathered millions and millions and millions of people across the country, you saw bands marching. Now, these were bands that many people aren't talking about in the English-speaking world, but in the Spanish-speaking world of the United States, specifically in the context of Mexican immigration and Mexican migrancy in the United States, bands singing in Spanish, who are commercially popular bands, are at the same time on the front lines of these marches and are the musical voices of migrant Mexican America. And I think that it's really, really important when we're talking about America, in quotes, that we're also talking about and thinking about multilingual music here, and especially not leaving out the central role that Spanish language music is playing in the United States right now in shaping all kinds of debates around immigration, you know, immigration and migrancy and all these other questions.
Well, gentlemen, I think that's a perfect place to leave it. And let me thank you all so much for this wonderful discussion. Josh Kuhn is professor of communication and journalism and also the director of the Popular Music Project at USC Annenberg's Norman Lear Center. Mark Levine is with us. He is professor of Middle Eastern history at University of California, Irvine. Richard Flax is emeritus professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.